Power Connected is the official audio and video podcast of the Miami University Alumni Association, available exclusively to the organization's dues-paying members.
All right. They hooked me up, which, you know, always, you know, well, what, you know, we shall see. Anyway, the topic originally, when Brian suggested I should come up to Chicago and talk to the alums, I thought, well, you know, did domestic, and we'll talk a little bit about gambling and speculation, what's going on, and then we'll do a little bit of international. Well, as you all know, not only is the domestic in the toilet, so is the international. But what I want to do is I'm going to do some very simple things at first and talk about a little bit of research that other people have done, talk about some of my own research. So the first thing I want to introduce, or not introduce, but talk about is a finding that I think most of you are familiar with, is that U.S. citizens have what we call home bias in their particular portfolios. There's very little international diversification positions that they hold. All sorts of psychological explanations for this. There's arguments that those markets are less transparent or they're riskier, and it goes on and on. So, way back when I first came to Miami, some of the original research that came out, one guy in particular, Bruno Solnit, I think he was at INSEAD in France, and he was connected to the University of Chicago crowd, et cetera, et cetera. And his research was on diversification in an international setting. And if we think about a domestic portfolio, a well-diversified portfolio that holds many different stocks across many different industries, what you can get the risk down to is what we call the systematic or market risk. You can eliminate a lot of that firm-specific risk because what you're doing is you make each firm a much smaller and smaller percentage of the portfolio. So some particular thing that happens that is unique to maybe that firm or its industry with a large number of holdings, that is a small impact on the portfolio. Solnit's research was to take it a step further away from just U.S. securities to see what a global portfolio would do in terms of a variety of international markets. And what happens when you do that and you take a look at the research, you can actually bring the variability of the portfolio return down by moving beyond purely a U.S. well-diversified portfolio. So the argument is unmade, and the empirical research there is to support it, that international diversification can reduce risk. So over the years, we've seen pension funds, endowment funds, all sorts of types of institutionally managed money move into the international arena. We had some portfolio managers, 2008, this would be, 1996-97, Miami grads return. And so they came in and got in him class, Ben Weston, another guy that worked at Templeton, and the hippie-looking guy, which was really good because the women just loved him. He was only like 37 years old and retired, managing his own money, with a ponytail down to here. And everybody was thought, I was thinking, man, I just want to listen to these guys talk. I don't want to teach class. They are good. And the one guy, Ben Weston, I think he was working for Credit Suisse at the time. 7 clients. That's it. His compensation that year, and I learned from Ken Burke later that he was upset. He only got paid $15 million. Right, yeah, I'm upset. Yeah. Can I have $1,500? Yeah, $15 million. So anyway, all of it was on the international scene, and his particular thing was where he made his clients' money was in the creation of the euro, the currency. And what happened to all those member states in terms of their yield curves and their fixed income, you got a convergence argument. So he played the longs and the shorts, made his clients a lot of money, and hopefully he gives it to Miami Business School, but we haven't seen much yet. But anyway, the bottom line was international is important, and the guy from Templeton said he had told his colleagues earlier in their lives, he says, you got to get your passport, you got to get out, and you have to start moving around the world, and you have to take your clients with you. Okay, so we know we have home bias in most individuals and their personal holdings. And the argument for moving against that bias is for us to hold more international securities, whether they're European, they're Asian, South America, some hope in Africa. But anyway, what you need to do is invest more abroad. Now, here's the problem. The fundamental argument was one of, well, they're less than perfectly positively correlated with U.S. markets. We may have correlation coefficients of 0.5, 0.6, 0.7, and a correlation coefficient can from negative 1 to 1. If you don't remember the statistics, that's okay. It's plus 1. Everything's perfectly positive. So you want less than plus 1. And they're going, oh, yes, 0.7, 0.6, great diversification benefit. Well, what's the new research say? What do you think? Anybody here? Pardon? No. First thing. How many people here, you got enough people, I think, over 40. And I'm over 60, so I'm hitting some, you know. Do you remember the fall of the Berlin Wall? Okay. And that was a great time. I stayed up and watched the television and people climbing up on the wall. And then a couple nights later, the Berlin Philharmonic played Beethoven's Ninth. Outstanding. It was a great time. Great excitement. And the historians started coming out with said, this is the end of history. There's no Cold War, peace and tranquility. The moon is in the seventh house, Aquarius, all that stuff. Yeah, right. Well, it was all nice. And the historian said, well, that's the end of history. And the finance people said, well, you got to diversify internationally. Because when markets get volatile, not all markets will go at the same time. Well, lo and behold, there's no end of history. And what the new research is showing is there are what we call correlation risk. The correlations themselves are not stationary, they change. And what this fall has shown us is that in extreme market downturns, it's getting close to plus one. And the volatility is even greater in these foreign markets than our own U.S. market. Indonesia went down 10% on Friday, or was it Thursday? Japan hit 9%. These other markets are even having larger down moves than we are. So where's the diversification benefit? Well, in these extreme situations, it's disappeared. There's been no safe haven of appealing to a correlation than plus one. In the extreme, what you have now is that we're all in it, and we're all in it together. Now remember, we talked about the end of history. With the historians, there was another argument that was percolating not too long ago in the last couple of years. Decoupling. The rest of the world is growing. We've got China, we have India, we've got the subcontinent, Japan, even though they've been in the recession for too long to even think, they finally came out of a little bit. Well, the U.S. is going to be less and less of the world's gross domestic product. These other countries are going to grow, and the world will be less dependent upon us. And I was reading this, and I'm going, gee, what a fantasy. That is absolutely crazy. Who's the most open work market in the entire world? We are. We define openness. Not the Japanese, not the Chinese, not the Indians. You can't go anywhere else where you have more open markets. And the old expression used to be, if the United States got a little cold, Canada got pneumonia. Well, guess what? We haven't decoupled in the financial markets. If anything, this crisis has shown us that it's there. And it's even worse. They even have greater volatility than we do. And if we move into a severe economic downturn, everybody else is going to be impacted. The Eurozone, Britain, Asia. There's no doubt about it in my mind. So I understand why there's this tremendous downturn in these markets. Now, does that undermine the argument for international diversification? And I will say no. Now, occasionally I watch Jim Cramer on Mad Money. I don't know if anybody watches him. And he drives me crazy at times, and I definitely can't have the TV on if I'm eating dinner because the guy that's making noise and he gets all excited about it. And I'm going, God, turn him off. But he had a great line. It's kind of like a gambler's line. And it's, he goes, there's always a bull market somewhere. And I heard that and I'm going, Kramer, not this quarter. Okay. I don't know. Does anybody know where there's a bull market? I haven't got a clue. All I see is devastation out there. Well, gold's even falling. Yeah. People said, oh, you got, I heard Kramer says, oh, you got to put money in gold. I'm going, that reminds me of, oh God, was Bill Cosby. Anybody remember Bill? He had the show and the kids, we used to watch it. He had a great routine on that with gold. In the 70s, after the second oil shock, gold went up 400, 500, 600, 700. And Cosby said, well, I listened to all my friends. They said, did you buy some gold? I go, no, I didn't buy any gold. Finally, he got so tired, he bought gold at $815 an ounce. Boom! And then it went down. And I could relate to that because in 1979, when Chrysler was on the verge of bankruptcy, and they lost, oh, they're just massive losses. I think they lost $1,550 million within a two-week span. They issued preferred stock and warrants, which the government bought some, and they knew, you know, would they approve the bailout? And I said, no, they're going to approve this puppy. I went and bought the warrants. And then, of course, they approved the bailout, and everything was fine. I made a lot of money. And, of course, I'm the greatest investor in the world. I sold those warrants in Chrysler because I made a lot of money. And gold was really high. It was like maybe six something. I can't remember. And I bought put options on gold. Now, put options, I'm going to make money if the price of gold goes down. And these was on a South African mining company, ASA Limited, a closed-end fund. What happened right after I did this? The Russians invaded Afghanistan. Gold goes to $800 an ounce. I lose all my money on my put options. And if I'd stayed in the Chrysler warrants, because what does Chrysler make at that time? The M1A1 Abrams tank. Chrysler stock goes up, the warrants go up, and I'm going, why didn't I just stay in it? Pardon? Yeah, and I was just like, I cannot believe this. But then I had a little bit of offset because my brother-in-law was the first White House fellow, a Catholic priest, George. Okay, he's now Monsignor George. And he was two doors down from James Schlesinger. So after the Iranian hostages were taken, our embassy, and are we going to go in and bomb them? I got the word early, no. Finally, we're going to negotiate. So I made some money off that in terms of playing the down pressure. So, yes, we have correlation risk, but I would argue the following. We will get through this crisis. We will get through this crisis. I don't know how long it's going to take. And right now is a tremendous buying opportunity in the international arena. The question is, how do you get in? And there are a variety of ways. For most individual investors, I would argue, take a look at mutual funds. Okay? The mutual funds, you can go to Vanguard, you can go to Fidelity. There are all sorts of funds. Vanguard in particular, I've got, which I'm using some of the 529 plans, essentially covers a large number of countries other than the United States. And if it's not through a 529 college savings plan, I can't remember what this thing's called. The toy, they got long names. Vanguard FTSE All World XUS ETF. This is on their ETF side, but they've got a, something equivalent on the mutual fund side. In other words, it gives you a broad exposure to the world portfolio. Now, I can make a pitch all day long and talk about go for these mutual funds or do this or do that or maybe take a look at ETFs. There is another dimension here when you're going international. It's not just the local market's return fluctuation, its variability. There's another issue that's in there. Does anybody know what it is? Well, political and your currency risk. I'm going to take you back in time. At the creation of the euro as a tradable currency, first I didn't think it was going to happen. And the guy that worked at Credit Suisse says, Leonard, you got your analysis is wrong. This is going to be a top-down forced issue by the countries in terms of their population. This will happen. I said, wow, I just can't believe it'll happen. Well, it happened. He says, the way you've got to think about it, he says, it's going to be a weak currency. Well, that's an interesting proposition. And he was right on the money, because when the euro started out, it eventually dropped down to 85 cents. It was a really weak currency. Over time, that has changed. The latest quote, yesterday, in fact, I had to look this up in the Wall Street Journal while we're finishing up the presentation on the university. Yeah, 134 on the euro. So it was as low as 85 cents. It's been as high as a buck 50 something, I think, 60. So if you go from 85 cents to a buck 60, that's a lot of variation. The yen right now, according to the Wall Street Journal, is about approximately 100 yen to the USD. Does anybody know the high on that in terms of the strength of the dollar? Yeah, you're too young. Pardon? Not to my knowledge. You have to go back to the summer of 1985, at the tail end of Volcker's campaign to bring down the inflation rate. At that summer, before they decided to bring the dollar down, it was 232 yen to the dollar. At that same moment in time, it was $1.05 for a British pound. Almost 4 D-mark to the dollar. Unfortunately, my kids too are too young, because what did I want to do? It's time to go party in Europe. Great time. Well, they brought the dollar down. I never thought Volcker would do it. I mean, I was totally shocked. I thought the man had some principle, but I understood the political nature. This is key. Having burned him in effigy in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Ohio because of the impact on the auto industry, by the summer of 1985, we were talking protectionist legislation. And there was a Wall Street Journal story. It was great. For a 2-week interval in which the dollar had reached its peak, it would have been cheaper for General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler to have all their cars built in Stuttgart and ship them back to the United States than to produce them in the U.S. So what does that mean for jobs in the United States? Bye-bye. They're gone. They're leaving. And nobody likes losing their job. That's why I bet on Obama. Ohio's going Democratic. I think Michigan's going Democratic. It's not that they understand the economic issues. It's anger. It's anger over loss of jobs and everything else, and you got to blame somebody. I'm not an Obama supporter. I think he's a little bit too left. But I'll bet my money, okay, where I think the outcome is going to be. So what we have, if you're going international diversification, is currency risk. And the currencies can exhibit tremendous volatility over time. Now, one of the currencies, well, up until the last 2 or 3 months, that needs to be changed, they're only doing it gradually. I got to change my language here. People's Republic of China. I'm too ingrained with saying Red China, okay? And some of my students who are back in China, Chinese students, who are doing, they develop some things called REDs. Seriously, real estate derivatives. Chinese student, great student. So the People's Republic of China basically is under a fixed exchange rate. Their currency needs to go up a whole heck of a lot. But they don't want to incur the political instability that that would entail of having a revalued renminbi or Chinese yuan against the dollar. So they're a little bit, okay? And I think that's creating tremendous problems in China in terms of their banking system. They're doing a lot of stupid things. But social harmony is much more important to them. You remember Tiananmen Square and the old cadre, the group there that had survived the Cultural Revolution. If you take a look at that whole history of China, you understand that harmony and keeping political opposition to a minimum is extremely important, and don't have any dislocations. And if you take a look at, was it Gulangfeng, if I got that right, the religious movement, yeah, you repress everybody, and you try to allow economic freedom. I don't know, Milton Friedman said they're not compatible, or to have repression on one side and economic freedom, you can't do it, but they have what's called now being called the China model that a lot of emerging markets are following. People, political repression, but allow you to make as much money as you want, as long as you don't challenge leadership. So anyway, we got currency risks. We got China that needs to revalue the currency. You got some other countries around there that think, well, this should happen, this should happen. In the last 8 weeks, whose currency has strengthened? Why? No, it's fear. It's called a flight to quality. If you remember when I was talking earlier today, after 9/11, okay, the U.S. dollar dropped against other currencies in the world, which I've been teaching international finance for, I don't know, 27, 28 years, long time. I was totally blown away that the dollar would weaken in a world crisis. You know, we're not exact, don't get upset with this. We are not a cowardly people. We are very vengeful people. Do not mess with the United States. I understand that. And I hope we never get to the point where, oh, I'll turn the other cheek. No. So when the dollar dropped, it didn't make sense to me. The attack was on the United States, but if anybody understands the United States, we'll go after you. We're just maybe a little more civilized than the Russians, who have a terrible reputation. We talked to the Germans in East Germany who survived after World War II. It's called payback time. And what the Germans did, no one cares what happened to them after World War II. I've read a lot of history on the Russian front, so, and talked to a lot of people who survived. I talked to survivors of the camps and everything else. But anyway, fear. That fear I didn't understand in 87. I do understand this fear because in the last couple of weeks, the dollar has been strengthening. And the reason it's strengthening is because the world is fleeing to our U.S. Treasury securities. So the driver for the dollar appreciation is coming from the demand of the safe harbor of the U.S. Treasuries. That's why your yields and your very short-term treasuries, in fact, I just pulled some quotes out here. As of Friday, the four-week was 68 basis points, a little bit more than one-half of 1%. Moving out to the 13-week, which I find a little strange, only 46 basis points, less than a half a percent. And if you go out to the 26-week bills, 1.1%. You've got tremendous fear out there, and so people are demanding U.S. dollars. In turn, they're using the dollars to buy U.S. treasuries. Thus, you see appreciation of the U.S. dollar. Ah, let's get back to my original argument, international diversification. When's the best time to buy? Well, I like to buy low and sell high, although there's so many occasions in my life I've done just the opposite. Think of a grid. Currency, whatever currency you're dealing with, whether it's a euro, the yen, Canadian dollar, hopefully not the what's that, Zimbabwe currency? Anybody following that? Robert Mugabe, what a hero. Anyway, you've got the currency either goes up or it goes down, whatever pair you're dealing with, right? And if you take a look at the local equity market, you can think it's either going to go up or it's going to go down. Now you can say, well, it could be no change, but you know, it's like flipping a coin. What's the probability of landing on the edge? Think of the number. There's an infinite set of numbers between 0 and 1, right? Or 0 and negative 1. Okay. So up, down, up, down. That's basically a 2x2 matrix. When I was in the Malaysian ETF way back when, in the Asian currency crisis, I had the wonderful situation of being in that matrix of negative, negative. Because I'm in an ETF on Malaysian securities, and their currency is called the ringgit. Well, in the crisis, what happens to the ringgit? It drops like a rock against the U.S. dollar because everybody wants to dump their ringgit and get back into USD. Well, not only do they want to drop the ringgit for U.S. dollars, they want to get out of the Malaysian stock market. So the stock market goes boom, the currency goes boom, Leonard's ETF goes boom, and even worse than that, the great leader of Malaysia puts on currency and capital controls, and the ETF can no longer be arbitraged to eliminate any premium or discount, so now I'm in discount even below its fundamental value. Wow, what a wonderful situation. I didn't know it was coming. Didn't know the magnitude and extent of that crisis. That was a double negative. However, at the opposite extreme of the double negative is the double positive. So if you're going to go into buying international positions, it would really be nice that when you go in, the dollar is strong. And it can buy a lot of euros, or it can buy a lot of renminbi, or it can buy whatever the currency is. And then if you really got great timing, it's at a nice strong value, right? And then maybe during the interval, the dollar will weaken. That is to say, the currency that you moved into will go up. Okay? Because you take your dollars, you buy that foreign currency, call it the euro. And right now the euro is what? $1.34? Okay. So now you moved out of T0 from your dollars into euros. You then take the euros and you buy a basket of stocks that trade in euros. If that eurozone gets better and healthier, and that will happen because the U.S. economy should better get healthy, it will go up a lot because it's dropped a lot more. So you get a big local currency return, a positive. You also get a positive on the currency you moved into. You got out of the USD, it strengthened. So now you got a positive, positive. Those are the two extreme cases. The more likely scenario is that what you want is a strong local currency, or excuse me, strong local market return, whatever the equities are in. And maybe the exchange rate doesn't fluctuate too much. Because most of the time you're either going to have a positive negative or a negative positive. That's where most of the action lies. But through time, it's my own personal belief that emerging markets and other countries will develop. They will move more to free markets or maybe open markets. The China model, even though it's politically repressive at the top, has demonstrated to the world that if you allow economic freedom, you gain more power in the long run. My biggest fear, which I mentioned 20 years ago, is what if the Chinese decide to engage in trade, to open up to their economy, which the Russians have never learned, they will be a military power second to no one in another 20 or 30 years. Because military power is ultimately a function of economic power. Chinese have learned that. So my argument for you as individual investors, it's not being anti-American. You have to protect your families and whatever. And the way to do that is to shift some of the portfolio into the international arena. You do that through mutual funds, or you can do that through ETFs, or you can do it through closed-end funds. Now, I have a propensity to talk too much. And I ran over in the earlier session. So let's open it up to questions. Anything that you have, let's see if I can answer on any topic. Go ahead.
We hope you've enjoyed this featured Your Connected audio or video podcast. If you have any suggestions for future podcasts, please let us know by emailing or calling the Alumni Membership Office.